This is part 2 of Unwelcome Guests, episode 593. We continue with Gwen Shulman on the three large Canadian NGOs doing deals with the mining companies.
That is now being used to finance these corporate social responsibility projects in Africa and in Latin America. And, you know, traditionally that has been the role of the corporation. They move into these communities. They set up their projects, and as part of their efforts to try to protect their reputations, they have invested certain amounts of money, usually just woefully inadequate and ridiculous, but in an effort to maintain a good kind of PR image, they have financed these projects. And now, lo and behold, in 2012, it's us who's financing them.
Wow. You talked about, you know, there's these two processes, and the corporate responsibility, corporate self-regulation was the one that came out. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, a partnership with the NGOs. But how was partnership defined, though, in this case? I'm unclear on exactly, you know, what do they mean by we're having a partnership with the NGOs? I mean,
okay.
You know what I mean?
Okay. So specifically what's going on is the Canadian government, USAIDA, has made this, as I said, taxpayers' money available to NGOs that will be working with Canadian mining companies overseas. So these are presumably short-term partnerships in the sense that money has been released to an NGO like Plan Canada to work with, in this instance, IAMGOLD, to do labor training in Burkina Faso. So for the duration of that funding, IAMGOLD and Plan Canada are partners working on a project that they've agreed to fund in collaboration with the Canadian government.
Okay. Now, you brought up Burkina Faso. Now, in talking about the actual environmental labor and sort of social mm-hmm. effects and policies of these mining companies, I mean, wasn't there recently some labor disputes and things in Burkina Faso implementing these, the mining companies?
Okay, so to be clear, that this labor dissent had nothing to predate the arrangement that Plan Canada and IAMGOLD have going now. So this initiative through CETA that we're talking about came after the labor unrest that was reported at one of IAMGOLD's sites in Burkina Faso. The point that Roberto and I were trying to make in the article is that IAMGOLD came down very hard on the strikers in the sense that the CEO was quoted as saying the bottom line is he is not going to tolerate, quote-unquote, an illegal strike. Very threatening statement. And what we were trying to point out was that now Plan Canada has partnered with a corporation that is on record as making it really clear that it will brook no dissent at its mines. And our question ultimately to Plan Canada and to the other NGOs involved in this is, do they not see what to us is just such a flagrant conflict of interest for the NGO? How can you be advocating supposedly on behalf of communities when you have tied yourself financially to the very companies that are perpetrating some of the abuses or creating some of the situations that are making things so incredibly difficult for these communities that are having to deal with environmental abuse, often human rights abuse? And so that's really our question, is what does that mean for the kind of advocacy role of NGOs? Now, a lot of NGOs do not assume an advocacy role, but still we feel that it can potentially conflict with the NGO's mandate of poverty alleviation and promoting the rights of these communities.
Yeah. Now, these are with, as I understand it, it's the three top NGOs?
Well, they're three leading. I wouldn't say they are the top, but they're all biggies. I mean, Plan Canada, WUSC, and World Vision are huge, huge mm-hmm. NGOs, absolutely. And as I said, I mean, I really have to point out, a lot of NGOs have decided they are not going to touch this money with a 10-foot pole. There is no way. So it's not like the entire NGO community in Canada is behind this initiative. Quite to the contrary, from what I understand, it's been the source of an enormous amount of debate and discussion and disagreement.
Well, that's good then.
Yes, one must take some hope from that, that's for sure. But it is disturbing that three of the most well-known and well-established NGOs quite apparently see absolutely no problem with this. And I feel very strongly that if that's their position, Canadians who help to fund these NGOs, not only, now through taxpayers' money, always through taxpayers' money, but also through private donation, need to be made aware of the kind of decisions that NGOs are making, and they need to really think about, is this what they had in mind when they were opening up their wallets and generously contributing to organizations with stated claims of really, ultimately, a solidarity with communities? And Roberto and I have a really hard time really buying that line when this kind of financial alliance has been made with mining corporations, and quite frankly, ultimately a dependency. Are they going to say no or refuse that funding if they decide that these mining companies are perpetrating abuses? I don't have the answer for that, but I strongly suspect it would be very hard to say no to it once they've accepted it.
I guess, as well as you're talking about, you know, there is dissent in this, and you talked about, you know, there's another way to go about NGO, what the NGOs are doing. Like you said, that, you know, there's the two processes, but only the one side really seen the light of day.
Mm-hmm.
So has it just come down to perhaps better organization of the NGOs, or is it sort of changing, I guess the best way to describe it is for more of the general Canadian sense of kind of the Starbucks culture, where, you know, you buy in the same way that you give, which is not really thinking too much mm-hmm. about what you're doing.
Well, I think what it comes down to really is politics. And what the Roundtable Initiative was trying to do was to really take this issue of abuses perpetrated by the Canadian extractive industry, take look at the roots of the situation and take on those abuses and say, look, we've given voluntary codes of conduct a try. In some instances, they work. In too many instances, they don't work. We need some kind of regulatory framework that will ensure that if these abuses are committed, that there will be legal consequences for it, as there are in Canada. But a Canadian mining company that works overseas is absolutely not regulated in any way whatsoever by Canada. What it does in Nigeria, Ghana, Peru is strictly the business of that company and that country. And there is nothing that we as Canadians can do to regulate or rein in its activities. And that, to me, at root, if you really want to address these issues, that is one of the ways to do it, is by addressing the root causes and holding our corporate quote-unquote citizens to account. And I think the other thing that needs to be pointed out that we haven't really addressed here that I would really like to see the Canadian NGOs involved in, but many of them are very mute, is the whole issue of Canada's role in helping to rewrite mining codes around the world that make access to mineral wealth in these countries much, much easier and much, much more lucrative for our mining industry. To me, those are the issues that really go to the heart of development. If you're concerned about poverty alleviation, let's look at what the Canadian government has done with strong lobbying by the mining industry to water down mining codes around the world. To me, that's development, but that's political.
Mm-hmm. I think we'll have to leave it there, Gwen, but thank you very very much for coming on it and talking about this, because, you know, it has sort of... like you pointed out before kind of the interview started, that this story has now kind of gone a little more mainstream, right?
Yes, it has. It was picked up yesterday by Samantha Nutt in the Globe and Mail, clearly inspired at least in part by our article. And once the Globe and Mail picked it up, then the CBC was all over it. It was the leading story yesterday on As It Happens, the leading story this morning on The Current. And this is great. And I see that it's generating the controversy that that is truly deserved, and that there needs to be a national conversation about this. And so Roberto and I are really thrilled that that more and more people are talking about this and are aware of the situation.
Yes. Now, I guess if listeners want to find out more maybe about what you do and what your work at CKUT, where can they do that?
Okay, well, as you said, the name of the show is Amandla. It's a weekly African current affairs show that's been on air for 25 years now. And it's on every Wednesday night, Montreal time, between 7 and 8 p.m. And can be also, you can get it off the CKUT website at ckut.ca. So every Wednesday, 7 to 8 p.m.
Now, good work reporting there. The duplicitousness of NGOs in the Bangladesh context, money going astray is fairly much taken as read. It's understood that if you want something done, then doing it is a good approach. Getting back to this show's theme of direct action to oppose the machine, this is an interview by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock, that's ecoshock.org, from November 2011.
Humans love those roaring jets so much, we hardly notice the 5% boost to greenhouse gases from all the jet fuel burned. You may not love them so much if you live within 12 miles of any airport, where the cancer, heart deaths, sleepless nights, and wrecked lives grow. It's not just the noise. Cancer-causing chemicals fly from the exhaust and drop into the communities all over the world. As the economy peaks in growth and starts to shrink in resources, the airline industry and their government booster pals still plan on a mad burst of expansion. Over 3,000 American airports plan new runways, like runway number 8 at O'Hare in Chicago or JFK in New York. Victims under the flight paths are blamed by the industry and abandoned by major environmental groups in the US and Canada. Not so in the UK. British and Scottish green groups boosted public awareness. 3,000 people camped out to stop the expansion of Heathrow Airport in London. They killed the third runway. We'll talk to leader John Stewart in Britain. He's been banned from America in a horrible loss for free speech and airport protest groups. In this program, you will hear what Stewart planned to say on the recent aviation justice tour in the US and Canada. Then we'll hear from one of the most experienced airport expansion campaigners in the U.S. Debbie Wagner has been fighting off pollution from SeaTac Airport in Seattle for decades. She knows where the cancer grows. I'll squeeze in a bit from British plain stupid campaigner Dan Glass, the man who super glued his hands to the Prime Minister's sleeve. He too got a visit from one of Obama's top FBI agents. I'm Alex Smith. The dream of mass flight for humans is killing the planet and wrecking the lands below. Get ready for a hard landing. There is another John Stewart, not the host of The Daily Show. This John Stewart is almost as widely known in his own country, the UK, and across Europe. Starting out as an anti-roads activist, John dedicated himself to stopping a multi-billion dollar expansion of Heathrow Airport in London. He faced an alliance of giant corporations backed by the highest levels of government. John Stewart lined up an impressive coalition of local homeowners. These were ordinary people fed up with noise and pollution. He hooked them into powerful environmental groups and a sympathetic public. In 2008, John was named the most influential environmental activist in the United Kingdom. But I want to make one thing clear to the many American listeners of Radio EcoShock. You are not allowed to hear John speak in the United States. John Stewart, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex.
Well, you were supposed to go on a long-planned tour of North America, helping local people organize against thousands of airport expansions. Tell us about your first trip to America.
Very interesting. Not at all what I expected. The plane arrived at JFK Airport, and suddenly six policemen burst into the plane, came up to me, asked that I accompany them off the plane, saying that a phone call had been made, that I had made threats against the president. I was marched through customs, then interviewed by immigration, the American Secret Service, the FBI, And 7 hours later, I was put on the next plane back to London. So within 24 hours, I was back at London Heathrow Airport.
John, you are an older gentleman, well-regarded in Britain, with no criminal record, and you were forbidden to speak in the supposed land of free speech. That's a little frightening, isn't it?
It certainly took me by surprise. And what is particularly frightening is I understood afterwards that while I was in the air on my way to the States, somebody had made a phone call saying that this person, identifying me, had made a phone call making threats against Obama. Now, clearly I hadn't done that, but it does seem to me that it was a great excuse for me to be interviewed at length. Once those sort of allegations had been made, they had an excuse to interview me, and it was perfectly clear from what the FBI was saying is that they did not want me to talk about the campaign against the third runway at Heathrow in the States. What particularly worried them, Alex, was that there was an element of civil disobedience, peaceful civil disobedience, in that campaign, and no way were they going to have that sort of message taken to the people of America.
Well, we certainly wouldn't want a lot of people in downtown New York or many of the other cities complaining about the system. Of course, that's what we have right now with the Occupy issue. John, I do want to get to the heart of the airport issue, but I want to just continue for a second with the civil rights issues of demanding a clean environment for us all. As you fought off these powers of government and the aviation industry in the capital of London, were you harassed or put under surveillance?
Almost certainly I was. Almost certainly we were. Because, as you said in your introduction, Alex, that this was a coalition which brought together ordinary householders, residents under the flight path, with young eco-activists. And the young eco-activists took what in the UK we talk about direct action, which I think, you know, is civil disobedience, against the third runway at Heathrow. Nothing violent. In fact, it was very non-violent. It was deliberately non-violent. But this was enough, most certainly, to put us and put myself under surveillance. And I think the basic thing is, it's the same as the people in the occupying the squares and the streets around the world today. We were fundamentally challenging corporate power. We were challenging the corporate power of the aviation industry. And I think when they felt we weren't going to be successful, they could dismiss us, they could ignore us. But then when it became clear that we had established not just a major campaign, but a movement across the UK, when they were really challenged and their power was challenged, then in my opinion, in my view, there's no doubt that I was put under surveillance by the various government and security services.
And most North American listeners have not heard of the police spy Mark Kennedy. Was he involved in this, and how far did he go?
Mark Kennedy wasn't actually involved in the Heathrow campaign, but he was a police spy, and it was a very big story in the UK, because the Third Runway campaign, it took place in a wider atmosphere of civil disobedience against corporations that were responsible for emitting CO2, the climate change gas. So there was peaceful actions against coal-fired power stations and against other targets. So there was a movement of several thousand people who took non-violent direct action. And it emerged earlier this year that this movement was heavily infiltrated by police spies, by people from the security services, including this guy called Mark Kennedy. Now, he had passed himself off for 6 years as an activist. In fact, he had had relationships with a number of the women activists, and it came very close to actually encouraging people to break the law. He probably did that. But he and others, it's now emerging, were embedded within the activist movement. And I think there's a book being published in the States called Green is the New Red. And the authorities seem to be terrified by radical green ideas, I think because they see them as a threat to the status quo. And therefore, people who are expressing, in many cases, what you and I may regard as perfectly common sense ideas, are targeted as the new subversives in a way that McCartney targeted so-called communists in the early 1950s in the States.
Yes, Senator McCarthy. Well, despite all this, and millions of pounds spent in public relations by the industry, the Heathrow battle was won in the public interest. Tell us how that happened.
Yes, it was one, and it was the biggest reverse the aviation industry in the UK and possibly in the whole of Europe had ever experienced. I think it's probably worth saying for listeners that Heathrow is the busiest international airport in Europe. The aviation industry for decades has wanted to see it expand. It's wanted a third runway and therefore was putting all its resources into making that happen. For the best part of the last decade, it also had significant support from the British government. So that's what we were facing. And I think we took the view, and I certainly took the view, that if you are facing corporate power in this way, you've got to try and meet power with power. There's no way that a few local residents on their own are going to win, however good their arguments. And that's why we attempted to build this huge coalition, which brought together local residents, environmental groups, politicians of all political parties, young eco-activists, conservation groups, to form probably the biggest ever coalition against an airport expansion in the UK. We challenged them on that. We also challenged them on a range of issues, climate change, noise, community destruction, and challenged fundamentally their economic case for a third runway. We did all that. And the way we did it was not just to sit back and wait for public consultations, but to set the agenda through public meetings, demonstrations, and nonviolent civil disobedience.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, aviation critic and activist John Stewart. John, your organization is known as HACAN Clear Skies. What does that stand for? And tell us a little bit about it.
The organization is HACAN Clear Skies, Alex, and a journalist once said to me, I don't want to be rude, John. Now, when somebody starts a conversation like that, you know, they are about to be rude. And he said, HACAN Clear Skies, that is simply the worst name I have ever heard. It's utterly meaningless. So let me tell you a little bit about how it came about. HACAN actually stands for the Heathrow Association for the Control of Aircraft Noise. Had been around as a residence group for many, many years. In the year 2000, it merged with people who had wider concerns than just noise under the name of Clear Skies. We put the two names together, and we got this organization called HACAN Clear Skies. But it did form the basis of this successful coalition, which defeated the plans for the third runway at Heathrow.
Let's get to the health issues of jet transport. What are some of the known impacts of living under a flight path?
Yes, I mean, this is why so many residents feel so strongly about these sort of issues. At Heathrow, people who are under the flight path, they have a plane going over sometimes one every 90 seconds right throughout the day. And all the evidence from across the world shows that noise at this sort of level stresses people out. It can lead to health problems, to heart attacks, to early death, to less productivity at work. And then for the people living close to the airport, there are the air pollution problems which come from aviation, which again can have serious impacts on people's health. Also for children, studying under the flight path affects on their education. But all that evidence is there. It's known. It's a highly inconvenient truth for the authorities and the major corporations. They don't want to hear this, because it's damning evidence of their activities. So what, of course, they do in a time-honored fashion is say, well, nothing's quite proved yet. We need more research. And in that way can conveniently sideline what is damning and conclusive evidence about the ill effects on people's health of living under a flight path or near an airport.
John, does the UK government set limits to the amount of pollution generated by the airport? Does anyone even measure it?
There are some limits set by the European Union on air pollution. The interesting thing is that Heathrow exceeds those legal limits, and the UK government is in danger of being fined as a result. There are minimal limits on noise. So, in effect, there's no real control over the noise and air pollution impacts of Heathrow Airport.
John Stewart, one of the big reasons for opposing a massive expansion of air travel is the greenhouse gas emissions which threaten the climate for all of the coming generations. What do we need to know about the climate impact of the airline industry?
Yeah, this is the big one. And this is why so many environmentalists in recent years have started campaigning on aviation issues. Let me just give you one or two facts which are startling and put this into perspective. The third runway alone at Heathrow would have created as many CO2, that's climate change emissions, in 1 year as the entire economy of Kenya. Aviation worldwide contributes around about 5% of all climate change emissions. Now, that may not sound much when you at first, but think about it. This is just one industry contributing 5% of all climate change emissions. And when you put that in terms of a country, that is more than the entire CO2 emissions in 1 year of the UK and Canada put together. Moreover, aviation is the fastest growing source of CO2 emissions. So this is what drives so many people to say, actually, it's madness for aviation to expand in the way it is proposed. It is thoroughly damaging to the climate.
John, let's travel to America now, although you're not allowed to do that.
Well, I can travel there, but I'll be sent back, Alex.
Well, I remind listeners, the American public is protected by the FBI against knowing what is happening in other countries. And you're just one of many activists who have been banned from entering the United States and prohibited from speaking. Well, John, what was your plan for the Air Justice Tour of North America?
Well, the plan was that myself and Dan Glass, who was one of the young activists concerned about climate change in particular, that we would have a tour of the states. We were invited by some of the community campaign groups in some of the cities like New York, Seattle, San Francisco, Santa Monica, who said, look, we've been fighting airport expansion, new runways for years, and we haven't been successful. And they were interested in what were the strategies behind our success. As we've talked just now, you know, it was bringing together local residents with climate change activists, building a big coalition, challenging on the economics, and being in your face with our tactics. That's what they wanted to hear about. And the idea was to go across the states by train for a month, starting in New York, taking in Chicago, California, and ending up, it should have been today, in Seattle.
This is Radio EcoShock with UK activist John Stewart. John, airport expansion, as you say, is always sold as a source of more jobs and more local revenue. Does it really work out that way?
No, it doesn't. And one of the key things that I hinted just now in bringing about our success at Heathrow, stopping the third runway, was that we challenged, probably for the first time, on the economics. Because when any of these big developments are proposed by the authorities or by the corporations, they say, ah, well, they're essential for the economy, they'll bring jobs. What they really mean is they'll bring nice profits to the corporations, but they sell them in terms of economics and jobs. And I think it's very often activists, and particularly environmental activists, are a bit reluctant to challenge the economics. We felt we had to do that, otherwise we're fighting with one hand behind our back. And we found in London that a third runway was not essential to the economy of London. Now, clearly, any new development does bring some jobs, but it's vastly overstated by the aviation industry. Their contribution to the economy is vastly overstated, because what they conveniently forget to tell us is the huge tax breaks they get. Across the world, there's no tax on aviation fuel. In most countries, they don't pay any sales tax. In the UK, we call value-added tax, VAT. And some of our economists have done some work in the UK which shows that the tax breaks the aviation industry enjoys means that the country is losing £10 billion. That's in the region of $15 billion a year because of those tax breaks. And that's never taken into account when the aviation industry says how much it actually contributes to the economy. Their figures have got to be taken with a pinch of salt.
I have to agree. You know, in America, I think that the cheap airfares, and these companies keep going bankrupt time after time. American Airlines is heading towards bankruptcy as we speak, but these cheap airfares have displaced the construction of high-speed rail in the United States. There just isn't any there. It's a wonderful point you raise.
That's absolutely right. These cheap fares are artificially cheap because of the tax breaks the aviation industry gets, and therefore they're generating an artificial market for air. But what they're doing is preventing the growth of high-speed rail in the States and in parts of Europe as well. And this is something we were saying during the campaign. I mean, we were very aware of people who work in the aviation industry. You know, we are aware that if there's not expansion, some of them may lose their jobs. We have to be aware of that because it's an absolutely terrible thing for someone to be pushed out of work. But what we're saying is what we would like to see governments in the UK and indeed wider in North America as well, is adopt the idea of what we call a just transition from jobs in unsustainable industries like aviation to investment in jobs in more sustainable industries like rail or like renewable energy. It doesn't mean to say there will be no aviation, there always will be, but we would like to see this switch, and we would like to see governments enable this switch to happen in a humane way, so that as people lose their jobs in less sustainable industries, as they possibly don't grow or they contract, like aviation, their skills can be used or transferred to working in more sustainable industries like high-speed rail. But at the moment, the power of and the self-interest of the aviation industry so blinds the governments to their alleged importance to the economy that they're not prepared to countenance this sort of strategy.
Well, it's not sustainable, too, because everybody's heard about peak oil. We're not going to be able to get aircraft fuel at such low prices forever. Eventually, we're going to run out of oil, or it will be so expensive we can't get it. And yet, Beijing just built the world's largest airport. It seems like it's almost a disease. Britain was going to be like a giant aircraft carrier where every plane in the world was going to land there. Well, what will it take to end this fantasy that's so dangerous for the climate?
It's difficult to know what it'll take, but you're absolutely right. If the aviation industry was smart rather than selfish, they would be saying, what's the smart way forward for aviation in the future? It is a contracted industry. It's an industry which is probably doing what aviation should be doing, and is that concentrating on longer intercontinental flights and allowing short-distance flights to be switched to high-speed rail, and also to promote video conferencing for a lot of businesses. Now, what will make the industry wake up? I think it is the shock that with peak oil emerging, with oil getting more expensive, they just won't be able to carry on as before. Of course, they are trying their best to do so. And that's why they're trying to develop new sources of fuel, and particularly biofuels. But again, the problem with biofuels is that they've got to come from plants, and those plants grow very often in the global south, and you either grow biofuels or you grow plants for food. So it's either food for the people in the global south or fuel for the aviation industry in the rich countries. They're trying every trick in the book to try and continue business as usual. And only once they realize that the fuel is just not available will I think they come to their senses and realize that the game is up for them.
John, as we finish up, could you give us a couple of websites to follow up and any comments you would like to leave with our listeners?
Yeah, I mean, you can certainly find out more about the Third Runway campaign on www.hacan.org.uk. And it also includes a little booklet I wrote about the campaign, which explains the strategies behind it, but also, hopefully, a little bit about the ordinary people and the activists who took part in it. So that's www.hacan.org.uk. And if you want to find out about the tour, which we should have been on, but actually took place, a lot of it, as we were Skyped into events, you want to go to www.aviationjusticeexpress.org. www.aviationjusticeexpress.org. And I think about a final thought. It is that ordinary people, committed activists, can win. We often feel when faced with the power of corporations and the inertia of government that little people can't win, that activists will lose. I think our story shows that you can take on the power of corporations, even when they're backed by government, and have a noticeable success.
John Stewart, thank you so much for joining us.
And that's a reminder of this show's basic message that corporations and money have no power of their own. Power which is sometimes attributed them is not their own, but it is usurped from souls crushed by the machine. To examine that mechanism further, we continue with David Graeber's debt the first 5,000 years. We're going to pick up where we left off with a question from episode 590. One question that isn't clear from all this is, why had money in particular become such a symbol of degradation? Was it all because of slavery? One might be tempted to conclude that it was. Perhaps the newfound presence of thousands of utterly degraded human beings in ancient Greek cities made any suggestion that a free man, let alone a free woman, might in any sense be bought or sold, particularly insulting. But this is clearly not the case. Our discussion of the slave money of Ireland showed that the possibility of the utter degradation of a human being was in no sense a threat to heroic honour. In a way, it was its very essence. Homeric Greeks do not appear to have been any different. It seems hardly coincidental that the quarrel between Agamemnon and Achilles, that starts off the action of the Iliad, generally considered to be the first great work of Western literature, is a dispute over honour between two heroic warriors over the disposition of a slave girl. Agamemnon and Achilles were also well aware that it would only take an unfortunate turn in battle, or perhaps shipwreck, for either of them to wind up as a slave. Odysseus barely escapes being enslaved on several occasions in the Odyssey. Even in the 3rd century AD, the Roman Emperor Valerian, 253-260 AD, defeated at the Battle of Edessa, was captured and spent the last years of his life as the footstool that the Sasanian Emperor Shapur I used to mount his horse. Such were the perils of war. All this was essential to the nature of martial honour. A warrior's honour is his willingness to play a game on which he stakes everything. His grandeur is directly proportional to how far he can fall. Was it, then, that the advent of commercial money threw traditional social hierarchies into disarray? Greek aristocrats often spoke this way, but the complaint seemed rather disingenuous. Surely it was money that allowed such a polished aristocracy to exist in the first place. Rather, the thing that really seemed to bother them about money was simply that they wanted it so much. Since money could be used to buy just about anything, everybody wanted it. That is, it was desirable because it was non-discriminating. One could see how the metaphor of the porne, that's the sex slaves, might seem particularly appropriate. A woman common to the people, as the poet Archilochos put it, is available to everyone. In principle, we shouldn't be attracted to such an undiscriminating creature. In fact, of course we are. And nothing was both so undiscriminating and so desirable as money. True, Greek aristocrats would ordinarily insist that they were not attracted to the common porne, and that courtesans, flute girls, acrobats, and beautiful boys that frequented their symposia were not really prostitutes at all, though at times they admitted that they really were. They also struggled with the fact that their own high-minded pursuits, such as chariot racing, outfitting ships for the navy, and sponsoring tragic dramas, required the exact same coins as the one used to buy cheap perfume and pies for a fisherman's wife, the only real difference being that their pursuits tended to require a lot more of them. We might say, then, that money was introduced as a democratization of desire. Insofar as everyone wanted money, everyone, high and low, was pursuing the same promiscuous substance. But even more, increasingly, they did not just want money, they needed it. This was a profound change. In the Homeric world, as in most human economies, we hear almost no discussion of those things considered so necessary to human life, food, shelter, clothing, because it is simply assumed that everyone has them. A man with no possessions could, at the very least, become a retainer in some rich man's household. Even slaves had enough to eat. Here, too, the prostitute was a potent symbol for what had changed, since, while some of the denizens of brothels were slaves,
others were simply poor. The fact that their basic needs could no longer be taken for granted was precisely what made them submit to others' desires. This extreme fear of dependency on others' whims lies at the basis of the Greek obsession with the self-sufficient household. All this lies behind the unusually assiduous efforts of the male citizens of Greek city-states, like the later Romans, to insulate their wives and daughters from both the dangers and the freedoms of the marketplace. Unlike their equivalents in the Middle East, they do not seem to have offered them as debt pawns. Neither, at least in Athens, was it legal for the daughters of free citizens to be employed as prostitutes. As a result, respectable women became invisible, largely removed from the high dramas of economic and political life. If anyone was enslaved for debt, it was normally the debtor. Even more dramatically, it was ordinarily male citizens who accused one another of prostitution, with Athenian politicians regularly asserting that their rivals, when they were young boys being plied with gifts for their male suitors, were really trading sex for money, and hence deserved to lose their civic freedoms. It might be helpful here to return to the principles laid out in Chapter 5. What we see, above all, is the erosion both of older forms of hierarchy, the Homeric world of great men and their retainers, and, at the same time, of older forms of mutual aid, with the communistic relations increasingly being confined to the interior of the household. It's the former, the erosion of hierarchy, that really seems to have been at stake in the debt crises that struck so many Greek citizens around 600 BC, right around the time that commercial markets were first taking shape. When Aristotle spoke of the Athenian poor as falling slave to the rich, what he appears to have meant was that in harsh years, many poor farmers fell into debt. As a result, they ended up as sharecroppers on their own property, dependents. Some were even sold abroad as slaves. This led to unrest and agitation, and also to demands for clean slates, for the freeing of those held in bondage, for the redistribution of agricultural land. In a few cases, it led to outright revolution. In Megara, we are told, a radical faction that seized power not only made interest-bearing loans illegal, but did so retroactively, forcing creditors to make restitution of all interest they had collected in the past. In other cities, populist tyrants seized power on promises to abrogate agricultural debts. On the face of it, all this doesn't seem all that surprising. The moment when commercial markets appeared, Greek cities quickly developed all the social problems that had been plaguing the Middle East cities for millennia. Debt crises, debt resistance, political unrest. In reality, things are not so clear. For one thing, for the poor to be enslaved to the rich, in the loose sense that Aristotle seems to be using, was hardly a new development. Even in Homeric society, it was assumed, as a matter of course, that rich men would live surrounded by dependents and retainers, drawn from the ranks of the dependent poor. The critical thing, though, about such relations of patronage, is that they involved responsibilities on both sides. A noble warrior and his humble client were assumed to be fundamentally different sorts of people, but both were also expected to take account of each other's fundamentally different needs. Transforming patronage into debt relations, treating, say, an advance of seed corn as a loan, let alone an interest-bearing loan, changed all this. What's more, it did so in two completely contradictory respects. On the one hand, a loan implies no ongoing responsibilities on the part of the creditor. On the other, as I've continually emphasized, a loan does assume a certain formal, legal equality between contractor and contractee. It assumes that they are, at least in some ways, on some level, fundamentally the same kind of person. This is certainly about the most ruthless and violent form of equality imaginable, but the fact it was conceived as equality before the market made such arrangements even more difficult to endure. The same tensions can be observed between neighbours, who in farming communities tend to give, lend, and borrow things amongst themselves. Anything from sieves and sickles to charcoals and cooking oil, to seed corn or oxen for ploughing. On the one hand, such giving and lending were considered essential parts of the basic fabric of human sociability in farm communities. On the other, overly demanding neighbours were a notorious irritant, one that could only have grown worse when all parties were aware of precisely how much it would cost to buy or rent the same items that were being given away. Again, one of the best ways to get a sense of what were considered everyday dilemmas for Mediterranean peasants is to look at jokes. Late stories from across the Aegean in Turkey echo exactly the same concerns. Nasruddin's neighbour once came by and asked if he could borrow his donkey for an unexpected errand. Nasruddin obliged. But the next day the neighbour was back again. He needed to take some grain to be milled. Before long he was showing up almost every morning, barely feeling he needed a pretext. Finally, Nasruddin got fed up, and one day told him his brother had already come by and taken the donkey. Just as the neighbour was leaving, he heard a loud braying sound from the yard. "Hey, I thought you said the donkey wasn't here." "Look, who are you going to believe?" asked Nasruddin. "Me or some animal?" With the appearance of money, it could also become unclear what was a gift and what a loan. On the one hand, even with gifts, it was always considered best to return something slightly better than one had received. On the other hand, friends do not charge one another interest, and any suggestion that they might was sure to rankle. So what's the difference between a generous return gift and an interest payment? This is the basis of one of the most famous Nasruddin stories, one that appears to have provided centuries of amusement for peasants across the Mediterranean basin and adjoining regions. It is also, I might note, a play on the fact that in many Mediterranean languages, Greek included, the word for interest literally means offspring. One day, Nasruddin's neighbour, a notorious miser, came by to announce he was throwing a party for some friends. Could he borrow some of Nasruddin's pots? Nasruddin didn't have many, but said he was happy to lend whatever he had. The next day the miser returned, carrying Nasruddin's 3 pots, and 1 tiny additional one. "What's that?" asked Nasruddin. "Ah, that's the offspring of the pots. They reproduced during the time that they were with me." Nasruddin shrugged and accepted them, and the miser left, happy that he'd established a principle of interest. A month later, Nasruddin was throwing a party, and he went over to borrow 12 pieces of a neighbour's much more luxurious crockery. The miser complied. Then he waited a day, and then another. On the 3rd day, the miser came by and asked what happened to the pots. "Oh, them," Nasruddin said sadly. "It was a terrible tragedy. They died." In a heroic system, his only debts of honour, the need to repay gifts, to exact revenge, to rescue or redeem friends or kinsmen fallen prisoner, that operate completely under the logic of tit-for-tat exchange. Honour is the same as credit, it's one's ability to keep one's promises, but also, in the case of a wrong, to get even. As the last phrase implies, it was a monetary logic, but money, or anyway money-like relations, are confined to this. Gradually, subtly, without anyone completely understanding the full implications of what was happening, what had been the essence of moral relations turned into the means for every sort of dishonest stratagem. We know a little about it from trial speeches, many of which have survived. Here is one from the 4th century, probably around 365 BC. Apollodorus was a prosperous but low-born Athenian citizen. His father, a banker, had begun life as a slave. He, like many such gentlemen, had acquired a country estate. There he made a point of making friends with his closest neighbour, Nicostratus, a man of aristocratic origins, though currently of somewhat straitened means. They acted as neighbours normally did, giving and borrowing small sums, lending each other animals or slaves, minding each other's property when one was away. Then, one day, Nicostratus ran into a piece of terrible luck. While trying to track down some runaway slaves, he was himself captured by pirates and held for ransom at the slave market on the island of Aegina. His relatives could only assemble part of the price, so he was forced to borrow the rest from strangers in the market. These appear to have been professionals who specialized in such loans, and their terms were notoriously harsh. If not repaid in 30 days, the sum doubled. If not repaid at all, The debtor became the slave of the man who'd put up the money for his redemption. Tearfully, Nicostratus appealed to his neighbour. All his possessions were already pledged now to one creditor or another. He knew Apollodorus wouldn't have that much cash lying around, but could his dear friend possibly put up something of his own by way of security? Apollodorus was moved. He would be happy to forgive all debts Nicostratus already owed him, but the rest would be difficult. Still, he would do his best. In the end, he arranged himself to take a loan from an acquaintance of his, Arcesas, on the security of his townhouse, at 16% annual interest, so as to be able to satisfy Nicostratus's creditors, while Nicostratus himself arranged a friendly, no-interest Uranos loan from his own relatives. But before long, Apollodorus began to realize that he'd been set up. The impoverished aristocrat had decided to take advantage of his nouveau riche neighbor. He was actually working with Arcesas and some of Apollodorus's enemies to have him falsely declared a public debtor, that is, someone who had defaulted on an obligation to the public treasury. This would first of all have meant he would lose his right to take anyone to court, i.e. his deceivers, to recover the money, and second, would give them a pretext to raid his house and remove his furniture and other possessions. Presumably, Nicostratus never felt especially comfortable being in debt to a man he considered his social inferior. Rather like Aegil the Viking, he would rather kill his friend Einar than have to compose an elegy thanking him for that overly magnificent gift. Nicostratus appears to have concluded that it was more honourable, or anyway more bearable, to try to extract the money from his lowly friend through force and fraud, than to spend the rest of his life feeling beholden. Before long, things had indeed descended to outright physical violence, and the whole matter ended up in court. The story has everything. We see mutual aid, the communism of the prosperous, the expectation that if the need is great enough, or the cost manageable enough, friends and neighbours will help one another. And most did, in fact, have circles of people who would pool money if a crisis did arise, whether a wedding, a famine, or a ransom. We also see the omnipresent danger of predatory violence that reduces human beings to commodities, and by doing so introduces the most cutthroat kinds of calculation into economic life, not just on the part of the pirates, but even more so, perhaps, on those moneylenders lurking by the market offering stiff credit terms to anyone who came to ransom their relatives, but found themselves caught short, and who could appeal to the state to allow them to hire men with weapons to enforce the contract. We see heroic pride, which sees too great an act of generosity as itself a kind of belittling assault. We see the ambiguity among gifts, loans, and commercial credit arrangements. Neither does the way things played out in this case seem particularly unusual, except perhaps for Nicostratus's extraordinary ingratitude. Prominent Athenians were always borrowing money to pursue political projects. Less prominent ones were constantly worrying about their debts, or how to collect from their own debtors. Finally, there is another, subtler element here. While everyday market transactions at shops or stalls in the agora were here as elsewhere typically conducted on credit, the mass production of coinage permitted a degree of anonymity for transactions that, in a pure credit regime, simply could not exist. Pirates and kidnappers do business in cash, yet the loan sharks at Aegina's marketplace could not have operated without them. It is on this same combination of illegal cash business, usually involving violence, and extremely harsh credit terms, also enforced through violence, that innumerable criminal underworlds have been constructed ever since. In Athens, the result was extreme moral confusion. The language of money, debt, and finance provided powerful, and ultimately irresistible, ways to think about moral problems. Much as in Vedic India, people started talking about life as a debt to the gods, of obligations and debts, about literal debts of honour, of debt as sin, and of vengeance as debt collection. Yet, if debt was morality, and certainly at the very least it was in the interest of creditors, who often had little legal recourse to compel debtors to pay up, to insist that it was, what was one to make of the fact that money, that very thing that seemed capable of turning morality into an exact and quantifiable science, also seemed to encourage the very worst sorts of behaviour. It is from such dilemmas that modern ethics and moral philosophy begin. I think this is true quite literally. Consider Plato's Republic, another product of 4th century Athens. The book begins when Socrates visits an old friend, a wealthy arms manufacturer, at the port of Piraeus. They get into a discussion of justice, which begins when the old man proposes that money cannot be a bad thing, since it allows those who have it to be just, and that justice consists in two things, telling the truth, and always paying one's debts. The proposal is easily demolished. What, Socrates asks, if someone lent you his sword, went violently insane, and then asked for it back, presumably so he could kill someone? Clearly, it can never be right to arm a lunatic, whatever the circumstances. The old man cheerfully shrugs the problem off and heads off to attend some ritual, leaving his son to carry on the argument. The son, Polymarchus, switches gears. Clearly his father hadn't meant debt in the literal sense of returning what one had borrowed. He meant it more in the sense of giving people what is owed to them, repaying good with good and evil with evil, helping one's friends and hurting one's enemies. Demolishing this one takes a little more work. Are we saying justice plays no part in determining who one's friends and enemies are? If so, wouldn't someone who decided he had no friends, and therefore tried to hurt everyone, be a just man? And even if you did have some way to say for certain that one's enemy really is intrinsically a bad person and deserves harm, by harming him, do you not thus make him worse? Can turning bad people into even worse people really be an example of justice? But it is eventually accomplished. At this point, a sophist, Thrasymachos, enters and denounces all the debaters as milky-eyed idealists. In reality, he says, all talk of justice is mere political pretext designed to justify the interests of the powerful. And so it should be, because insofar as justice exists, it is simply that, the interest of the powerful. Rulers are like shepherds. We like to think of them as benevolently tending their flocks. But what do shepherds ultimately do with sheep? They kill and eat them, or sell the meat for money. Socrates responds by pointing out that Thrasymachos is confusing the art of tending sheep with the art of profiting from them. The art of medicine aims to improve health, whether or not doctors get paid for practicing it. The art of shepherding aims to ensure the well-being of sheep, whether or not the shepherd, or his employer, is also a just businessman who knows how to extract a profit from them. Just so with the art of governance. If such an art exists, it must have its own intrinsic aim, apart from any profit one might also get from it. And what can this be, other than the establishment of social justice? It's only the existence of money, Socrates suggests, that allows us to imagine that words like power and interest refer to universal realities that can be pursued in their own right, let alone that all pursuits are really ultimately the pursuit of power, advantage, or self-interest. The question, he said, is how to ensure that those who hold political office will do so not for gain, but rather for honour.
This and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download as MP3s from unwelcomeguests.net/archive. There's a mailing list at altruists.org/unwelcome for any discussion relevant to the show. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.
Let your life be a friction to stop the machine.